Welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. I am excited to be talking about a show I've looked forward to for over a year. My name is Glenn Dagle Shivers from the podcast of Ice and Fire Forms. I am honoured to be joined by...
Hey, hi everyone, it's Mary. I'm Miria on Discord and the previous podcast.
Hi, it's David HHH on the Discord, the forums, and wherever the hell you want to find me.
I am Jock, Munlo Jock 2 is my forename.
And when, I was talking about when I first heard of the show, so that would have been with the Sun, so the Scottish Sun, as you'll know, Jock, newspaper, on a Saturday, they do a free magazine, so a TV magazine, mm-hmm. And what they've started to do is talk about, shows that might be coming up within the next month, or in some cases it's like shows that are in production that might be, 6 to 8 months before you see them. So this was, I'm sure, late 2019, when I flipped open and seen it talked about a show by Russell T Davies called Boys,
right.
Starring Ollie Alexander, and I was like hooked straight away reading that. But interestingly, it was billed as something you can see in the summer, so it took a bit longer than that before we got to see it, but finally it's here. But of course, with a different title, it's a sin.
Right.
What is everyone's thoughts on the title change?
Well, Amazon had The Boys, so they couldn't use
that. I was thinking that, yep.
Russell said that was wise. So. And it's a very different. It's a very different show from The Boys.
Absolutely.
Although
I didn't realize he had confirmed that was the reason, but that's why I thought it was the reason was for the change.
Right. He mentioned it in one of either the after shows or the thousands of interviews they've all done since.
And the show, it does have a lot of heartbreaking moments. A lot of the characters' stories end, very dramatically. And we will, of course, talk about that. But I thought we would start with something just like a bit lighter, some of the later moments in the show. So one that stands out is the choice of music. So you have songs like Heaven is a Place on Earth, it's my favourite song of the 80s, The Wild Boys, Only You, It's a Sin, of course, and many other 80s classics.
Right. One of the things Russell wanted to really do with this, and he said this in a bunch of interviews, is to show that for all the craziness and awfulness we lived through, it really was a super fun time, too, which is weird and hypocritical, but it's not hypocritical, but just goes against it, but it really was. It was like it was so much fun, and that music, I think, in many ways embodies that, and making it so integral to the show, kind of infuses it with that all through. Because that was what happened in those days. I mean, gay kids from all over the country and the world flocked to the cities to come out to escape their lives and to be gay, and to live the life, quote unquote. And it for all the some people may criticize that it focuses on the bars and the clubs, but that was our life then. That's all we had. And that was our fun and our craziness. And we lived that music and we went out dancing 3, 4, 5, 6 nights a week. And we had fun. And lots and lots of sex. But, that's what we went to the cities for. And then it turned out we were in the middle of ground zero of a pandemic, epidemic, but...
I think the music design did a great job at creating a contrast between the good scenes and the darker scenes.
Oh, here's one that's really interesting. This sort of touches on a topic that Mary and I were talking about on the Bridgerton podcast, a show in which there's many different ethnic minorities in the show, and, the thought behind casting and, people applying for jobs and giving that chance. Whereas Russell T. Davies has said that, at least the four main lead characters are gay.
He said every speaking part actually is LGBTQ.
All right.
Every single actor in the speaking part, he said, believe it or not.
Oh, I was wondering because, you know, there are a lot.
Right. That's what he said. I don't know if that's completely true of every character, but that's what he said at least. So, but definitely all the major ones. So.
And he was on like a few interviews about that, defending that choice.
Yeah, it became kind of a media firestorm. A lot of, you know, prudish people were very upset about that. Like, how dare you? He had to defend it.
What are everyone's thoughts on that?
I honestly don't think that's an issue, because I don't think... I think with all of the actors out there, you're going to find someone talented who's gay, and you could have found someone talented who's not, but if your choice is to have LGBTQ actors... in your show, I think you're gonna find people talented enough.
And absolutely.
Like, yeah. I don't know how it happens in this industry, but in my own in music, I do know that honestly, you have so many talented people. You're always making the choice between 2, 3, 5 really talented people, and you're making it because you thought this one was like nicer, or seemed like she's more reliable, or this one has like the right hair for what you were looking for. I don't know, but there's always like little things, and honestly a lot of subjectivity into how you choose your singers, your players, your actors, I think. So really, I don't think anyone lost an opportunity because he chose to cast only LGBTQ characters. And I have actors, I mean, and I have actually also, like, I also think that when you want to redress the balance, it doesn't work to add both sides. Like, you have to have some bold actions where you on one go give a lot more representativity to an ethnic minority or a sexual minority. I do think that was really in line with the show and a really great choice to do that. I honestly didn't know about it, but I guess it wasn't such a big deal in France, not that controversy, just the show in general. I only heard about it from the UK, basically, so I didn't know about that specific part of it, but I'm not surprised, and at the same time I didn't think about it once during the show. I thought it was very well acted. I thought the characters were all very like diverse and interesting, but I didn't think, okay, so he had one Indian guy, one black guy, and I didn't think about it this way. I just all diverse and interesting characters. It doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter, specifically because they are diverse. But yeah, so I'm all for it.
I think Russell handled it well in the interviews. He talked a lot about representation and, like you said, balancing like the scales where, yeah, you could say this isn't fair for straight actors or whatever, but what about all of the LGBTQ actors out there who've had trouble getting roles because people won't cast them, you know? And he said that this one little thing can help balance that seesaw just a little bit. And I'll agree with that. He also said, and I think there's something to be said for this, that there's a certain authenticity. And he said that for all the people who had complaints about it at first, once it aired, everyone stopped complaining because, let's face it, these actors were perfect. You know, they carried it so well. Like, was there any question that they were inhibiting these characters? I don't think so, at least not for me. You know, they definitely felt it. You know, although I do see on the other side that point of view of like, well, you know, should you then ban like LGBTQ actors from playing straight characters? And his answer to that was, oh, no, that's fine, because LGBTQ people have spent their whole lives pretending to be straight. So they should be good at it.
Yeah, I'm a bit torn on this issue. So what part of me is thinking, oh, well, it should be just an equal world, gay or straight, they should have a chance to get that role. But, and the flip side, gay or straight should have a chance to play a straight role. But I know that does not happen. And then when I think of, you know, the three, you know, three major films come to mind that are like LGBTQ, that would be Bohemian Rhapsody, Rocketman, and Love, Simon, all played by straight men.
And Call Me By Your Name, too.
Oh, yes.
Two straight men playing lovers in that one. You know? I mean, on some level, I get you're an actor. Your job is to play someone that isn't you. So I get that anyone should be able to do that, and it should be fair. But in the real world, that's not what happens. Partially because there aren't a lot of...
Also is that it's way easier to play someone that isn't you when you've seen those type of characters on TV before. And I think actors learn from everything and everyone around us. Right. And since, including in the media and in TV shows and in movies and in their own lives. And I think we've seen way less LGBTQ characters than we've seen straight characters. Right. And even in our lives, given everyone who's not out and who's not maybe living their life as truly as they could want to, it's also fair to say, I think, that straight people do not necessarily have the have seen enough LGBTQ people around them to really play them. And I think that's a transition, you know, it's not going to be like this forever, it shouldn't, but as long as it is this way, you need that authenticity. And I agree that I mean, it's like everything that's designed to redress the balance and all of that. It's no one hopes that it's gonna have to be like this forever, like I mean, no one hopes we're gonna have to have quotas and stuff like that to have as many women as we have men in positions of power, but for now we need them, and we hope we will be able to get rid of them soon. I mean, and I think it's the same with this, and in a perfect world, gay or straight, it doesn't matter, you can play everything, but it's not yet the case.
Yeah, I agree mostly with what Peter have been saying. The only point I disagree with would be having an entirely LGBTQ cast for I think it might be a bit better if there was some straight people just to keep up a bit of collective diversity in that sense.
But I think the point was not diversity in this case. And I think it's all right to not want for diversity when there's been so much not non-diversity in the other way around. So like it's I mean, I always go back to music because that's what I know, but I'm a proud defender of women composers, and I bet that not many of you can like cite one. And I can. I mean, I have 2,000 of them in my database, so they're there, they exist, they existed, including in the past. And I think it's worth like having some festivals that are just about music they have written, because those festivals are not about being inclusive, and they are not about being diverse, even though the music itself is diverse. They are about showing that they wrote a lot of music, and I think this is about showing that you can have, that it's even possible to have a cast full of LGBTQ characters, and that all of them are talented. And because the one thing you hear a lot is stuff like, yeah, okay, I get that you would want a woman to sing or rather to play or to compose that piece. I get that you would want a gay man playing this character, but are you sure you're going to find them? Because there are not that many out there. Right. And that's wrong. That's just not a good argument. So doing this shows that it can work.
And it also gives a spotlight to some really great actors. I mean, all these people are now hopefully going to go on to be successful because they're awesome. You know. Oh, yeah. On a different controversy, real quick. It's interesting, since you mentioned Bridgerton, it made me think of this, is how right after the show aired, certain of the UK media in particular were making a big deal about how people were being offended and appalled and shocked by the, like, explicit sex. But then on social media, a lot of people mentioned how just days before, those exact same newspapers and magazines were talking about the hottest sex scenes in Bridgerton. It's like, what a, like, how dare they? And meanwhile, like, nothing in this was actually explicit. I mean,
we didn't see anything right. more than we would have seen in a non-explicit TV right. show with straight couples, right. honestly.
You know,
like, we see just people kissing and kissing.
I mean, we see that, like, they're fucking, yeah. but we don't actually see it, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's interesting that yeah. you know, that these papers made such a big deal about, like, people are shocked and whatever, and then two days before, they did an article about how hot the sex in Bridgerton was.
Yeah.
Yeah, the tabloids in the UK are pretty much trash.
Right.
Like, they are run basically for the lowest common denominator.
Right.
I know lots of people in, like, the radio were pissed off because in radio and television, like, you need to be, like, non-partial and biased
right.
and think about these things, but, like, newspapers can just basically go on a rampage of, like, complete nonsense and get away with it, whereas if the same thing was tried by, like, a radio host, like, as this, they'd get in a lot of trouble for it.
Mm-hmm.
I love how scandalized everyone was by the "you need a wash" scene. That really, like, upset a lot of people.
And I'm interested, David, so obviously in the UK it's still, like, I still see articles about it, and, you know, I'm sure you'll you know, the impact on it, on, you know, people going out to get HIV tests as well right. is, like, through the roof. Right. What's it been like in America? Has the show been well received over there?
From what I gather, yeah, it's hard to get a good judge these days because I get most of my information online, like everyone. And frankly, I've already been looking at a lot of articles and stuff about It's a Sin, Google and all that will put that in my feed. So I'm probably seeing more of it than is out there. But it seems like it's, you know, a lot of people are talking about it. And it seems to have been very well received, although there's a few controversies that we'll talk about later.
Mm.
But it's, most people seem to have loved it as much as in the UK. I don't know if it's such a, like, overwhelming everyone's talking about it like it was over there. As much, I mean, I'm also in AIDS activist circles a lot, so obviously they're talking about it a lot. So.
I don't think I know anyone in France that watched it. I mean, I did talk about it to a few people, but I kind of told them, I'm not sure I want you to watch that. No, I thought it was a great show, but I did say I don't think that's what you're looking for in terms of having a feeling good and nice
right.
show that
yeah, it's definitely traumatizing.
Cry for hours watching it, and I stand by that. I also think that if it weren't for that podcast, for this podcast, I wouldn't have watched it right now, I think. I would have
right.
waited for a time in
it's
my life.
It's a tough time
when,
in the world.
where I don't feel depressed all day and I can watch a depressing show.
That said, I felt like it was affirming in a lot of ways as well, though.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
I mean,
yeah.
you know, yeah, it's traumatizing for sure. And I know a lot of people didn't want to watch it for that. But I mean, I also saw so many stories, like if you look on the YouTube comments to the after shows and stuff, so many people saying how they planned to only watch the first episode and stayed up all night because it was so engrossing and they loved it so much, as awful as it was, you know. So I think there's that aspect to it. And I think it does. I also saw a lot on social media of, you know, gay men who lived through the era who, A, were traumatized by it, obviously, and brought back a lot of tough memories, but also a lot of happy memories, not just of, you know, the good times we had, which, you know, I think that the show really did embody that a lot. But also, you know, all the great people we lost, and it brought back, you know, I mean, yeah, that's triggering in a tough way, but also in a happy way when you remember people in your life that were wonderful, you know.
We can focus on, you know, each of the, well, five main characters, but then there's some others that we can also talk about. One that, you know, well, not really a main character, but I thought that there's two. There's Gregory, first of all, and then there's Donald, who both contract AIDS. And sadly, we know that Gregory dies. And then, you know, his parents burn everything that he ever owned. Right. All the pictures, all the memories, they just want to erase him from his life. Like a really harrowing ending to the second episode.
Right.
But then there's also, you know, Richie's boyfriend, Donald, who we know or think that he does have AIDS. But it's just sort of like a mystery of what happened to him. But yeah, it's
but it happened.
It touches on something that Russell T Davies said in one of his interviews, and it was just about at that time period that if someone changes address, you know, this is the days before social media, email, so they just lose contact with these characters.
Oh no, totally.
So in the case of, you know, Gregory, Jill sending him a letter, and then she never really finds out.
Yep.
I'm guessing she just never finds out if he actually dies. Yeah. She just thinks, well, he never replied to my letter. And likewise, you know, with Donald, that he disappears, goes back to his family. Does he have the same fate as Richie, or maybe he did survive? So I think that's something that's really a powerful message for me, that lost touch with these people, and that was, as Russell T Davies said, that was it. That you have no other way to get in contact with them.
Oh no, that was our lives then. I mean, you know, you'd see someone in the club every night or every week, and then you wouldn't. And you know what? No one really asked because you didn't want to know the answer. You know, I mean, and that was not. I mean, that was very common. I mean, people disappeared. And we don't know why. And part of it was that, you know, I mean, you had people who were your friends, and then you had the people you like casually saw out, you know, but people did disappear. We don't know if they went home. They went to the hospital. They went to the morgue. I mean, just everyone. I mean, I don't think people realize the amount of people who died from this. I mean, depends on where you lived. I mean, in a big city, especially. I mean, I know people who lived in the burbs and outside and didn't go into the cities much, didn't know a lot of people. But I mean, there are people who could literally name hundreds of people they know who died. And that's how bad it was in some areas. You know, I mean, I remember particularly like as an ACT UP member, I'd go to New York to the meetings there. And if someone was, my first thing I would do is look around the room and look for people like, you know, like, oh, thank God they're alive. You know, because especially they lived in New York and I lived in Boston, and you wouldn't, you know, it's not like you were on social media chatting with each other like you would be now. You know, I didn't know they were alive until 6 months later, the next time I went to New York and I saw them there sitting in the room, and I'm like, phew, you know, a little subconscious. And the funny thing is, at the time, I don't think I was even aware I was doing it. It's just, that's how you lived your life back then. You know, people just disappeared. Hundreds and thousands of people just disappeared.
On that point, I found it really tragic in the first episode when Henry, Colin's colleague, he's mentor. Like alone in and mentor. He's like alone in his hospital bed with really horrific imagery, by the way, because like he's locked in there and his I'm not going to say husband because they couldn't marry, but his partner is back in Portugal and he has no way of contacting him. Mm-hmm. And I found that really, really tragic that these two men who had been together for like 30 years just died far away from each other without knowing the other's fate.
Yep.
And I was like, the first, we don't know them really well, and we're not like, it's just, I found that really tragic in the first episode, and also the fact that they don't know what's happening to them and they cannot imagine how bad it is. Like, he even jokes about it when he says, oh, it's gone, and he sees the look on Colin's face and then says back to Portugal laughing. Like,
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, I think we also have to remember we're talking different times here. This series goes through like a decade. And I mean, I think the time at the very beginning, before they really knew what HIV/AIDS was, I mean, thank God I didn't. I mean, I lived through that, but I was a kid and didn't know any better. I can't imagine being like gay in that time when people start getting sick and dying and not knowing why. I mean, it's just such a terrifying time, you know, and I can't even imagine it. There's a documentary, I think, called We Were Here about San Francisco and when at that time. And it's just so, I mean, I can't imagine how terrifying it would have been to have been out in the community at that time. I know how bad it was by the time I came out, by the time I came out, it was in 86, and we already knew what HIV was, and we more or less knew how it was transmitted. Not that the government wanted to tell us this, but, you know, but we knew a lot more, and how the difference between at the very beginning of the crisis and the first episode or two of the show and later on when we kind of knew more. And I think that is also something that does get left out of this series. And one of the criticisms people have of it is how much the community itself, the gay community, came out and educated each other and took responsibility for teaching each other, and how, you know, safer sex became the norm. And we, you know, you couldn't go to a club without someone handing you a pamphlet and three condoms and, you know, and something else. But really educated each other. And that's the only reason it wasn't way worse than it was.
Didn't you think that maybe it was a bit different in the UK? I mean, they kind of say that, and like when Jill is looking for information and Colin goes to New York, and she's like, they know more out there, and they're telling us more, and they don't have the internet to go and look because you have to actually go there and talk to people, and so she asks them to. Yeah,
that's true. But it took a little longer, but it did happen over there. And I've read a lot of stuff online from people who lived in London at the time who've said that, oh, no, we absolutely got safer sex education and people were giving out condoms and all that stuff was there. Now, not in 82, 83, 81 when you're
at the beginning. But they show that in the show, but maybe not enough. And maybe there were supposed to be more scenes with that. I think it's also because Richie's such an AIDS denier that you don't see that, because he's actively refusing to listen to this to the people trying to educate him about it.
Right. I mean, I think it is tough to really judge a show given that it was meant to be 8 episodes and we ended up with 5. But but we can only talk about what's on screen.
Yeah.
There was a big disconnect between two things. The governor's response was very much against it. Like, they didn't even allow sexual health surveys, were quashed by the prime minister, and lots of the sex education was stopped. Luckily, we have a thing called the Wellcome Collection, which finances medical research, and they finance the sexual health surgery. They financed a lot of the sexual education as a charitable body. So lately we did a lot of work getting the information out there.
But you also had Clause 28, which forbid anything that in any way, quote unquote, promoted homosexuality or quote unquote support, if it accepted homosexuality as an acceptable lifestyle, like if it said anything positive. So how do you can't really talk about like, hey, fuck with a condom, because you can't say that. You can't say
exactly
that.
Exactly. When it's illegal to promote sex between men, how can you tell them, oh, do have sex but with condoms? Right.
And definitely early in the epidemic.
Benign as a surgery got completely stopped by the government until charities stepped in to provide the information.
Yeah, I mean, definitely
the government was very much against, like, the exact opposite of the response. Like, they were trying to actively not respond to it.
Right. definitely in the early days of the epidemic, I mean, the message that got out there was not, here's how you do things safely. It was, and this is both in America and in the UK, it was, don't do it. Just don't have gay sex and you'll be okay, you know, or don't have sex at all unless you're married, you know. That was the message that they put out there. And to even say, like, do anything else, you can do this, it's safe, was very controversial. The Surgeon General of the United States was fired for saying that masturbation was a safe alternative to unsafe sex. That's how bad it was back then.
Honestly, like, you keep saying back then, and I know, like, I knew that it happened. I knew that it wasn't so far from us, obviously.
30 years ago.
Yeah, and when I thought about it, I was like, oh my God, 30 years ago. It's like when I used to think about the Soviet Union when I was a teenager, and I thought, oh my God, this was like 20 years ago. And it seemed so bizarre that it was so close to me, because it felt like it was done and not like the Soviet Union is done and the wall fell and everything. And this is not actually that simple, and it's the same for AIDS, but I it just struck me to think again. Yeah, this wasn't that. I mean, I was born in 1993, you know. It's not that far. It's crazy.
I know.
It's that amazing. We had that kind of behavior as a society. And I don't mean the behavior to proudly out and have sex. I mean the behavior to lock people in their hospital rooms.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how the generations growing up now have no idea that most of this happened. You kind of know there was AIDS, but I mean, do any of you have any sense? Did you have any sense of how bad it was?
Definitely not.
I mean, even Glenn, I know you're a little older and you're gay, but I mean, how much of a sense did you have of it?
Well, I knew that there were like a huge number of deaths from it. So, you know, when you think of coronavirus at the moment, there's like 2.5 million, whereas it's like 10 times that with AIDS. But I don't know how they're measuring that by, like over what period of time. Right. But
and also remember, it was when you take it on such a smaller community, you know, how devastating that is. Like the difference between how many people in America died versus how many gay men in the gay community in Boston died. You know what a difference that is. You know. A larger number in a smaller group is much more devastating. One of the things you mentioned, Marie, is that you knew that some of your friends were upset that, oh yeah, they're talking about AIDS again. Why does it always, when we're talking in the 80s, have to be about AIDS? It's like, I don't think people realize that was omnipresent. I mean, there wasn't like a day, if you were gay in 1987, 1989, 1990, like there wasn't a day it didn't impact you, whether it was a friend going to a hospital, it was someone, you know, if there was a protest you had to go to, or, you know, I mean, every time you had sex, you had to think about it. You know, it was just, it was there. It was like, it was just hovering over your entire life. And I don't think anyone who didn't live through it could understand. Think of how right now COVID has hovered over your last year of your life here. Even if you haven't had it, even if you didn't get it or don't even, you know, have friends who died of it, like how much has COVID impacted on your entire life right now? That's kind of how it was for gay people in the 1980s and 90s. It just was there all the time. Like when Richie has that line where he says, you know, can I just have a day without this? You know, it sounds like a dick move, and it is. But I mean, that's really how we felt. It was just like, my God, it's everywhere.
I think my friend's point, to be fair to them, was more that, a show about gays, so it's going to talk about AIDS, and that was an issue for them. But I tried to say, like, kind of the opposite or more, a show about the gay community in the 80s, yes, it's going to talk about AIDS more in distance. And I mean, it's like, it's... I mean, yeah, we talked about it, but Yeah, I can imagine that it was everywhere, and omnipresent at the time.
And David, you talked about that originally it was 8 episodes, or that's what the original plan was, but sadly Channel 4 bosses only wanted 4, eventually it became 5, which is still great, because we don't know how much was condensed into those 5 episodes.
Right.
But I always think Ash is the most underwritten compared to the rest.
And he got nothing.
what would Ash have done if there were more episodes? That's what I always think too.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you meet Ash, he has an on-off sexual relationship with Richie for years.
Right.
And I guess then later in episode 4, he has a mini storyline where he becomes a teacher and he experiences a lot of discrimination at work.
In Clause 28.
Yep.
Directly, yep. Yeah, I mean, that was a good story. I like the little bit of, like, what did you want to say versus what did you say? Like, you know, I mean, it's all well and good to say we all want to be out there screaming activists, but at the same time, when your job's on the line, you got to be careful.
And you know the whole scene where they have him go through all these books in the library, the school library, and find gay characters or any mention of gayness? It really reminded me of, there's this great episode of Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, and she the town introduces a library, and in that, you know, like initially first, you know, 20 minutes of the show, everyone's loving the library, having it there, it's helping a lot of people, some that don't have access to books, but then someone finds something that's like a bit racy in the in a book, and suddenly becomes scandal within the town. Everyone's against the library, and you know, it's a really great show of herd mentality and what that can lead to. So eventually they're burning all the books, and then Michaela reads a passage from a book, and the Reverend grabs the book, burns it, and then she says that was the Bible.
There you go. It's true. Everything's controversial to someone, especially out of context.
But it did surprise me that, you know, reading through like all these books like Shakespeare and know that there was nothing there.
I mean, whatever was there was probably, you know, subtle. If you look for stuff, there's stuff all throughout history and, you know, literature. But a lot of dimensions of anything, homosexual, bisexual, were all very... you know, very subtle, because that's all you could do. You know, you wouldn't get it published, or you wouldn't, you know, you could be killed. You could be thrown in jail, you know, depending on where you lived and what time period you're talking about. So there were lots of writers and who wrote about LGBTQ issues, but had to do it very subtly.
So I'm not at all knowledgeable in all that, in literature in general, but I also think that there are some earlier mentions of gay communities but something that wasn't thought of as gay at the time. Like I'm thinking about ancient Greece or something like that. But when we learn about it now, it's seen as this very this is very far back into our history, and this is kind of this weird little thing about the Greeks, but no one really think about it in terms of homosexuality. It's like, yeah, and they also had sex with men, but that's like a little.
But back in the 80s, you wouldn't have ever even mentioned that. That wouldn't have come up in class. That wouldn't be in a textbook. Yeah. That would be or some book that would be in the library. That's the thing. So. You know.
Well, the movie Troy got a lot of flack for taking out the homosexuality out of that storyline.
Which movie? I'm sorry.
Troy.
Okay. Yep. But that happens a lot. I mean, it still happens, but especially back then, you know. Luckily, we're slowly evolving as a society, but... We're not quite there yet.
And I think homosexuality is subtly in Shakespeare's work.
Right.
Like with Lagos and with Hathor.
Yeah, but still, a lot of it's still subtle enough that you wouldn't necessarily see Section 28 banning the books.
I mean, we always have to bring our podcast back to A Song of Ice and Fire, but like, yep. How many of you caught that Renly was gay until it was like spelled out to us? I didn't. So
actually, when I watched the show first, but I have friends who didn't.
Yeah, I didn't. For sure. Yep. So, I mean, it's also like even in a modern 70s, book written, it wasn't written. It was written a while ago, but even then, it was there, but it wasn't very obvious, and it wasn't obvious because it couldn't be obvious in that medieval world, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So, Roscoe's story. Obviously comes from a Nigerian background, I think. Mm-hmm. And his family are talking about taking him back to Nigeria, where it's, you know, a lot more dangerous than, of course, the UK at this time. And, you know, luckily he has his sister there. She gives him £120, which must have taken a long time to save up, 'cause it's like a massive amount of money at the time. And, you know, he gets set up within, you know, London. I think at this point he gets the job in the bar. Mm-hmm. And then I guess I think that the story with Stephen Fry, I don't know, I always thought that was, I don't know, it didn't feel right. It felt a bit out of place compared to the rest of the series.
I don't know. I liked it. I mean, I feel like he was trying to include a reference to, you know, closeted, successful, you know, people, particularly in government. I mean, that definitely, right. I'm sure there were plenty of those characters out there, you know, that did that. I'm sure there are plenty of Tory MPs. I mean, let's face it, that character, you know, that his lover there, the member of parliament, he most likely voted for Section 28 if he'd been a real character. You know, he would have voted for that because he was a Tory and he loved Margaret Thatcher. And, you know, and there are certainly plenty of gay men who did that, you know, voted against their community and against themselves, you know, and it's awful, but it's true. And I was actually really surprised in, you know, that they had, you know, Roscoe protesting against her by pissing in her coffee, but more for like the personal affront than for like, I'm surprised they didn't bring up any of how like Thatcher was awful on AIDS and she was responsible for Section 28 and how, you know, the government response was, I mean, maybe not as bad as America's, but was still pretty bad under her. And I was surprised that they kind of put her in it and then let her like kind of let her off the hook a little bit.
To me, that scene is more about him taking it out on his gay, but oh no, I'm not gay.
Exactly. I think that was more a protest against. It was more of a protest against the MP there, Garrison, than against her. Right, and that's what I was surprised about. Like, you had the perfect opportunity to make this like, you know, maybe have him had seen a headline or something about her the day before, and then that like brought it on. But it was more a personal thing. And I guess on some level, I think that's kind of where he was going, where he was trying to blame this Glazek case who loves her policies and cares more about that than his own community. And the personal affront of like that whole, like, the line he uses there of something like, you know, he called like basically being with Roscoe as like being in with the shit or whatever he called it, like, that was just what a like horribly personal affront that is, you know. But at that said, how fabulous was Roscoe all through it? I mean, he's just such a large personality. The outfits, you know, I mean, he was filming in the cold in those outfits he talks about in some of the interviews, but like, he's just absolutely fabulous, and he so embodies that role. I mean, if there's anyone when you're going to talk about, you know, authenticity. That character is extremely authentic in the way he plays it.
Yeah.
You know, everyone knows someone like that, you know. and our community was so much the better for the Roscoes out there, you know.
At the same time, Roscoe has like one of the happier endings.
Right. Well,
initially his parents don't accept him, you know, they're doing these really comical prayer scenes.
Right.
And then, you know, they're planning to like take him back to another country. Then there's a long period where they don't talk to each other, like over the 10-year period. Then eventually his family grow to accept him, which I think is amazing.
His father apologizes to him, which to me didn't feel very true to life, to be honest, but but I think it was more because he went back home and saw how badly AIDS had devastated everything, and that was part of it, but I don't know. It didn't feel very authentic to me, that part of the story. By the way, if you didn't know, if he had done another episode, if he had had the 8 episodes, he was going to do an episode that was a flash forward to the present. And one of the things we would have found out is that Roscoe did later catch HIV. And that's just so heartbreaking, you know. But that's also very true. I mean, there were so many people who, like, you know, I was in ACT UP with, who were literally fighting, you know, to get education out there, who ended up getting it. It's just like, and years later even, and that's, we're human, we make mistakes, we do things, and it's tragic. And I mean, we're still, you know, thousands, tens and hundreds of thousands of people are contracting HIV now. You know, even though we've got all this knowledge out there and we've got PrEP and we've, you know, which is a drug that can prevent HIV infection. And we know that if someone has HIV and they are, and they can, if they take the drugs to suppress it and they can get to the point where they're undetectable, they can't actually give HIV to anyone else. But even with that, we still have, you know, so many people catching it now, which is so heartbreaking for those of us who fought to make things better, you know. But at least they're not all dying, so there's that. I'll take that.
Yeah. But it also reminds me of, you know, some of the characters in the show. So, you know, the guys that are handing out the flyers, right. And then eventually you see them in the hospital because they have it.
Yep, yep. That's how it was. I mean, just everywhere.
Yeah. It's also worth remembering that the viruses were only discovered in 1976. There really wasn't much time to understand it by the time that AIDS hit everyone.
Right. Well, I mean, they estimate that over half the gay men in New York had HIV before they knew what it was. I mean, think about that. Half.
That's absolutely crazy. And but when you, that might be a nice transition to another character when you see Colin.
Right.
Who you feel is going to be safe, right? Because it doesn't seem like he's having a lot of sex.
Any.
I actually thought it was going down that road. So, like, by episode 2, you know, there's me thinking, oh, I really hope he gets a boyfriend. But then I was like, oh, no, when he gets a boyfriend, he'll then get HIV. Right. And that's where I always thought it was going, that, you know, they're portraying this character as very innocent and not...
And it's even worse, like, because... It shows that he had it way before anyone else.
And before anyone knew what it was.
Anyone knew, yeah.
Yep.
So sad.
That storyline. I mean, did Colin not break anyone's heart?
Oh, I left him.
I mean, he was the sweetest guy in the world, and he goes through the most awful, awful. I mean, watching him have his seizures and his mind going, it was just so... so awful, awful to watch, but so real. And I mean, being locked in the hospital room, like that happened to people. That's just so,
ugh. From the context of the show, he's portrayed as someone that's, you know, not attractive, even though he is really attractive and he's got a Welsh accent.
Totally hot.
from the show.
I believe he's attractive, even though he's not for me.
right. I mean,
from
come
the show,
on. Who wouldn't marry Colin if they could? If you're not already married.
But I guess from the show, it's sort of putting, you know, we're led to believe that he's not attractive. But was the, you know, and from the scenes where we've seen him with the landlord's son, you know, he was actually getting excited about, you know, being alone with him. So why do we think that he decided to abstain from that, from sex?
Honestly, I think that his relationship with that boy is very, very toxic. And I think that's also why he flees to go and have a room in that big house. Right. I think it's to flee that relationship.
I mean, I feel like his character, you know, his character is very shy and quiet, and I think the relationship with that boy was very toxic and dangerous, but I feel like that makes sense because here's this kid who's confused, and I'm sure he is turned on by this boy. The boy was kind of hot, but at the same time it's abusive and it's rape, but he kind of was excited about it. You could tell from the little bits in his eyes, like when he thinks about her, when he talks about it, like, oh, are you going to be away all the time? But he's also a little afraid because it's violent and it's nasty. And I think that makes sense that from there he becomes what we see. Like he doesn't look like he has a lot of self-esteem. He doesn't seem to. So I don't see him the type that would be out there throwing himself out there trying to have sex a lot, because he doesn't see himself as attractive. He doesn't think he deserves to be happy and have good sex in a relationship and all that. And, you know,
I think that doesn't mean he wouldn't have sex if he meets someone who didn't, how to say this? I think their way of meeting people is very, very specific and might not work with everyone. Like, not everyone wants that, even, I assume, in the gay community in the 80s.
Right.
And I think if Richie had been nice to him...
Oh, he totally would.
...hadn't been Richie...
right.
I mean,
oh, he totally would have.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of that is self-esteem issues. I think it's clear
absolutely.
He did. And, I mean, to have a victim of abuse have self-esteem issues isn't exactly surprising, you know?
Yeah.
but what a sweetheart he is, and just to watch him go that way. I mean... Like, to see the dementia like that, you know, I mean, I remember I never saw it directly, but I mean, I remember we were having protests for, like, I mean, he most likely had either PML, which is progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, or toxoplasmosis, or there's a few other things that led to that kind of dementia, you know, and it's kind of crazy that 30 years later, I still remember that, you know, but as an AIDS activist, we were fighting for, like, research into that, because there was, like, none, you know, there weren't treatments for it, there wasn't even research as to what they were to a larger extent. And, you know, and that's what happened to people. I mean, imagine your mind going on you. I mean, in any disease, it's awful. But, you know, and then finding out you have AIDS, too. It's like, ugh, just awful. And the awkward scene of him telling Richie about his...
That was very controversial as well, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it was just awkward, but... Of controversy.
I felt really
very...
sad for his mother and for him same.
For everyone. It's just awful. Oh. And then the nurse comes in and just scolds him, because that's how they would do it back then.
Such heroes.
And the awful team in the hospital when they're talking to his mother. Oh. How much do we love his mother, by the way?
Oh.
It's so
fantastic.
It's so nice for someone on this show to have a supportive and wonderful mother, you know, because there were, for all the awful mothers out there, there were plenty of great ones too, you know. There were plenty of mothers who, you know, who joined the groups and, like, and made and headed up the quilt and, you know, headed up the money, headed up the raising money and food and whatever for people with AIDS and did caring and you know, especially after their kids died, a lot of them just jumped right in.
We also have Jill's parents.
Right. Jill's parents were pretty good, too. And speaking of which, you know that her mother is actually the real Jill.
Oh.
The actress in real life, Jill Nalder, who played her mother, is the real Jill that Russell based Jill, the character Jill, on.
Awesome.
Which is really cool.
Yeah.
Well, if we're going to talk about Jill, I mean, how much do we love Jill? I mean, And there was a Twitter trend of Be Like Jill trended for like weeks after the show came out. Because the
well, I guess I sometimes think Jill Ash at the same time that at the same, you know, she obviously had a lot to do, but she's not within, like, you know, when the show starts and it introduces mm-hmm. Colin and Roscoe, mm-hmm. then Richie,
right.
you know, obviously making it clear that those are the main characters.
Right.
But then Jill also has a large part to play in the story. But I just think how much more could have been done. Obviously, you've talked about the flash forward scene when she's
right.
55 and
right.
meeting Roscoe. Once they've of course grown apart. Mm-hmm. But I also think, oh, you know, if there was those eight episodes,
they filmed some scenes where she actually started to get a relationship with one of the actors in the Les Mis production that she was in.
Oh, right, okay.
Unfortunately, they cut those. They did film some, apparently, but they did cut them, unfortunately, for time. So, would have been nice for her to have something besides just living AIDS all the time. But then again, to be honest, if you were, like, in the middle of it back then, that was your life. I mean, that a lot of people think that it's weird that she didn't have anything else, but that's exactly what would have happened if you were, like, you know, imagine if all your friends were sick and dying and you were, like, devoting all your time to helping them. That's what happened. A lot of Jill's, that was their story.
I would also add that the show spans like 10 years
right,
and
right.
we see very little of that. So
right.
Obviously we see what is related to the subject right. Mainly. And we do not see her, I don't know, visiting her family, going
right.
on dates,
right.
having other friends. I don't know. And we, as you said, we only see what's, we can only talk about what's,
right.
on TV, but it's, yeah, it's still, we don't see a lot about these characters, really, when you think about it. There's not many real simple moments where
right.
we see them. I mean, it's all to do with the subject.
What I'll say, though, is I was really, really glad to see them giving so much time to the character of Jill in this story, because I really think that the women in the AIDS crisis are the unsung heroes of it. I mean, you had all the women in care, you had the nurses, you had the people who would do the stuff that everyone else was afraid to do, you know, the people who brought food like Jill did, the people who just held someone's hand, the buddies, the people who sewed the quilt panels, the activists. I mean, you had, I mean, in the ACT UP movement that I was part of, you had so many lesbians coming out for their gay brothers to fight for us and our lives, and, you know, and taught us a lot, because a lot of them had a history of from the women's movement and the civil rights movements, and taught us, you know, sometimes the nickels and dimes of here's how you organize a protest, you know, here's how to get arrested and stuff like that. I mean, we used to have civil disobedience trainings, and they were usually headed up by lesbians who had experience in the movement, and they literally taught us. It was great. And I mean, think about how, you know, hard it must have been for them to put themselves into a world of death, you know, to help people, and all that they personally suffered and had to, you know, we talk about trauma, they're just as traumatized as us, you know, and I think it's nice to see the women getting the credit they deserve in this show.
It's just, it is something, and you can argue that it's what society tells us to do, and it's we should fight against that. But it is something that a role that women willingly choose often, mm-hmm. even still now.
But I mean, I think it takes a certain kind of heroism to put yourself through that emotional toll.
I do. Yeah. I'm not saying. I mean, right. I have nothing but admiration for all. Even still now, all of the nurses out there, mm-hmm. My mom, including men, of course, but
right.
my mom is a nurse, and she works mainly with old people and people she has to, like, who she has to tell again day after day that your wife is dead and there's no point in calling
God.
Her. And
oh,
I mean, I honestly don't know her. She's not, I mean, she's depressed, so I don't. It's it is very hard, and I cannot imagine how it was in that specific situation, So I agree entirely that this is a very nice...
And finally, we've got the lead star, so Richie's story. But one thing that sort of annoyed me was when Ollie Alexander went on to the Graham Norton show to promote the show. This was like 2 weeks before it came on air. You know, he was introduced a few times by the hosts as musician turned actor. So that annoyed me because I know that he's always been an actor. He's, you know, he's been in a lot of movies that I've probably seen him in, like half the stuff that he's been in. And like long before he joined a band, he was an actor. So that was just like a little niggle. But yeah, he's been in, of course, things like Great Expectations, you know, all these little small roles. But I think this is the first lead part that he's had.
And what a role, eh?
Yep, absolutely.
Speaking of Richie, did you like Richie? Because I feel like
I did like him in the sense that from watching the TV show, but I know that if I knew him in real life, I wouldn't like him.
he's meant to be like, you know, the hero and whatever of the show, you think, but you know, the actor himself calls Richie kind of a dick in one of the interviews, and I think that's very true. And we certainly get like,
I'm sorry, for me, characters dying are not, it's not just about, I'm not sad because they die, although that's, yes, I'm sad about that, of course, and it's tragic, but what really hits me is seeing the people left behind.
Right, and that's what I was going to say, especially Jill, especially Jill.
They are. Jill and Ash and all of them. And
Richie's
Roscoe.
Mother.
Yeah, and Richie's
somewhat.
Mother.
Richie's mother, different, because we hate her. I
well, different, but it's still very tragic. I mean, we can talk about that scene as well. I understand everyone's point of view on it. Like, I understand Jill being angry, and I was really, really angry, and it felt really unfair that he died there instead of dying with all of his friends.
I did sort of see Richie's mother's point, though. You know, he's barely seen his family in years.
Of course, that's what I was saying.
Well, there's reasons for that.
but still, put yourself in his mother's shoes. She didn't have the time. She loved her son. You can't say, I mean, in not the right way. I mean,
it's hard for me to take her point of view at all, even. I understand. And there's certainly aspects to it that we didn't have time to get into. If we had had that last episode that Russell had wanted to write, Jill was going to go back and visit the family, and she was going to find out that there's a history of sexual abuse in the family, which is lightly hinted at in what actually aired.
I didn't really see that, but that
might have changed my opinion.
From the mother or from the father?
It's not clear, but I mean, there's just the occasional line here and there, like the sister's really afraid. And there's a bit I saw, like, I remember when she makes a comment about her father and when he died and he was a horrible man and stuff like that. So I don't know what exactly it was, but there's definitely like bad stuff in that family, you could tell, and it's hinted at. So on some level, she's a victim, or maybe she was an abuser, or both. I don't know. But often isn't that the way life is, that the victims become abusers? But I mean, she was an awful person, I have to say. I felt like even before like the AIDS thing happened, like she was bad to him. She was, you know, and the father wasn't much better. But I mean, the moment she finds out, she's just scornful of him, like, how, you know, she's mad. And then no matter how much she feels left out and she feels angry and sad and horrified, I mean, it's going to be awful to find out at the same moment that your kid's gay and has AIDS and is dying and has cancer and is dying now. Like, that's awful. But I mean, nothing is going to excuse keeping him from his friends on his deathbed. You know, I mean, they were out literally there trying to help him and to help her son. And obviously that's what Richie would have wanted. And she lied to him to keep him to herself because she was selfish and she felt like she had been denied like life with him that and was jealous of Jill. And like because of that, she made her son suffer and die alone. I mean, that's just so awful. And I can't even like put words to how angry I am at her over this. And I don't blame Jill for a single word she said to her because Jill was feeling the same way I am right now about her. Like,
she's I'm not blaming Jill either. I'm just thinking that it's a very horrific situation for all involved, even though she had, she's responsible for part of it and she's responsible for a lot of suffering. Right. And I'm not saying, let's all forgive everyone because it's all right and it's fine. I'm just saying it is forgiveness is a possibility and repentance is a possibility. And I'm just thinking that final scene between Jill and her must have been really traumatic for her as well.
Right.
And I'm never gonna wish mental health to someone. I'm never gonna wish for them to have to live with that kind of thing forever. So I do think that some kind of resolution to that years after that would have been nice.
Right.
I'm not saying what she did was okay, and I'm saying Jill wasn't right in telling her off. Yeah. But I think it's very tragic for everyone.
Whatever else you want to say, it was an acting tour de force for both of them. That scene was just amazing. Mm-hmm. It was just amazing. Keeley Hawes is like legendary in England, and
oh, definitely.
she's talked about, you know, that scene and how hard it was to do, and you know, and how much she hates this character but tries to make her a little, you know, sympathetic, but it she said it was just so hard because what she did at the end was so awful, and it was. I mean, not just awful to Jill. I mean, what she did to Jill was awful, but what she did to her own son because of her jealousy of Jill is just unforgivable. So one other thing, since we're talking about that scene, one other thing, though, that has been very controversial, particularly in, like, the AIDS communities, is how, first of all, Richie, on his deathbed, talks about, you know, or before he dies, he says, you know, how many people did I kill? And then Jill brings up the same thing in there, and then her blaming the mother for making him not care about himself and others and killing so many other people, and how that really became like a flashpoint of criticism for this, particularly from people with AIDS who said that, like, you're blaming us for what we did. And I feel like the scene as it was really blaming homophobia and the mother, but I could see how you could take it as blaming him for spreading it. I mean, because as much as, you know, Richie was a victim and was living through a horrific thing, and, you know, as much as there was a lot of things happen and it's tough to judge people, there is something to be said for the fact that he continued to choose to have unsafe sex after he died. And I mean, after he was diagnosed, and that's an issue, you know. And I think that
when I was watching it, I was thinking, wow, that's a really difficult thing to, as a viewer, that's a really difficult thing to hear your lead character say, mm-hmm. that he's done something that's quite despicable.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think back to, if I was living at the time, and, you know, it's viewed as this death sentence,
mm-hmm.
and I was sort of, I'd like to think I wouldn't be this cruel, but I guess you might think, if I told people that I had AIDS, then I would never have sex again. And I only have so long left until I die. Right. I might as well enjoy myself.
Right. Right. But that has consequences, you know, and I think this is also where I think a lot of this is coming from, is that there's a certain segment of the community that is very, very aggressively pro barebacking and really fights back any time anyone even hints that that might not be the most ethically nice choice. you know, and I think that's a lot of where this is coming from. And in fact, some of the people who've written things about it, I know for a fact are actively like barebackers who think that like it's the best thing in the world. And that to even suggest that in the middle of the AIDS crisis, when you knew you had HIV, to bareback was not morally the most wonderful thing in the world, get really upset about that.
And in fact, there's a really great episode of Queer as Folk, mm-hmm. American version, mm-hmm. Where Ben meets a guy in a library,
right?
And he wants to have HIV. He's read one of Ben's books about it, that he has HIV, and mm-hmm. obviously Ben says no because he's married to Michael. But eventually, he sees him again and learns that the guy's been to a party, a beer party. Slept with about 8 different guys, and you know, like
the bug chasers.
Bug chasing, exactly.
that's a whole other like psychological sinkhole. It's just, but there definitely is a fight in the community over those who were pushing for safer sex, you know, even as much as a few years ago, and those who said that don't do that, you're taking away my freedom and whatever. And I mean, I think the PrEP has really changed that discussion a lot, because with PrEP, for those who don't know, is a drug you can take to prevent getting HIV. That changes the dynamic, because it doesn't have to be you can't get it.
Not 100% effective.
Right.
But yeah, mostly. I was about to ask, because, and I don't want it to be offensive, but how actually safe is it? Because I learned of it like maybe 2 months ago, when a friend explained to me, an older friend, I should say, he's like 45, who's gay, explained to me, and he was really so matter of fact about it, and really like, basically, HIV doesn't matter anymore, because we should all take PrEP and be safe.
Right.
And I thought, whoa, that seems too good to be true.
Yep.
Well, it should, in an ideal world, be set up like an extra precaution that people should still be using condoms, and they would have PrEP, but sadly, it doesn't work that way, and people most just decide not to use condoms because they have PrEP.
Right.
And it is very effective, but not like 100% effective. And in fact, there was a guy that, based on It's a Sin, and there's quite a few articles now around HIV, a guy that was on PrEP since the age of 19, he's now 24. And he now has HIV, but he was only the fifth person in the UK that's been on PrEP that has HIV.
Right. And of course, you have to use it you have to take it every day, which, you know, we're human, we make mistakes. And I mean, I think this is a much larger discussion than we can have here. But the quick version of it is basically there was a lot of fighting in the community over, you know, if we're giving this out and basically giving up on condoms, which effectively we are, unfortunately we shouldn't be, but we are, is that, you know, what's going to happen? What's going to be the results? Are more people going to get HIV? What happens when people slip up? And, you know, what about other STDs? I mean, there have actually been a huge spread of chlamydia and syphilis and gonorrhea since PrEP came along, because everyone's fucking barebacking. I mean, unfortunately it doesn't stop everything. And so there are consequences to that. But that said, it's better than the whole fucking community dying, which I lived through. So I'm happy to have a drug that will stop people. I wish people could use it a little more responsibly, and people still would use condoms and stay safe. But I understand that we're human and we don't always do that. So I'd rather have something that can save people's lives. And the other part of this,
I mean, to be honest, condoms are not 100% effective either. It really is about how.
Although if you did both, if you take, you know, 99% and 98% and you put them together, you're talking really super effective. But people don't use both. And that's just the reality of it. But there's also the other aspect of it, which is called treatment is prevention. Which is that they now know that if you know, they have the antiretroviral drugs that are keeping people with HIV alive. And if you take them, and you take them all the time and regularly, you can get to the point where the amount of HIV in your body is undetectable. And once you're at that point, you actually can't give HIV to someone else. I mean, theoretically, it's possible, but I mean, realistically, it doesn't happen. So when you take these things together, PrEP and treatment as prevention, we should theoretically be able to eliminate AIDS in our lifetimes. Let's hope we can, but I mean, that's certainly a goal a lot of organizations are fighting for in the UN. But so that's certainly a place I never thought I'd see in my life. So I'm glad we're mm-hmm. there, even if there are consequences and, you know, social and political and medical changes.
Yeah. Well, one other thing that I wanted to talk about was around, I've seen it before. I know that David's seen something around it that this show has brought to the forefront, getting HIV testing done.
Right.
And mm-hmm. it's particularly difficult just now with social restrictions. A lot of the health centres are closed. So normally, you know, you would go for a 3-month, 6-month checkup and mm-hmm. do everything, you know, HIV, chlamydia, all the sexual diseases, but you can't really do that right now, sadly. And I do fear what sort of impact that will have once, you know, restrictions right. are lifted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been this long year and a half period where people have had sex and they've not been tested. So what sort of impact that might have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the plus side, you can get tests through the mail. You can get home tests. And
you can get home tests, but
not most people probably aren't. But Terence Higgins Trust did say in England that they've had record number of people ordering it because of the show, so that's good. So that's one positive thing.
Yeah, HIV, yes, you can get a free one from there, but the other tests a bit more difficult or more expensive to do. So and in fact, when I ordered one myself, you know, I watched the show and decided, mm-hmm. oh yeah. I seen other people posting about it, and I thought, I'll order one. It came through, messed up.
Of course. Oh, no.
Messed up, you know, simple test instructions, but I messed up. Then ordered it again. And this time I did everything, followed everything correctly. Like, there's like steps 1 to 12. And then, you know, put my blood in, waited the 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, the way the test is built, it's a C and a T on it.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a line next to the C, you're negative. Then if there's a line on both, then you do have HIV. So there was a clear line on the C, but then there was like a little dot.
Oh no.
Sort of dash
oh, no.
on the T.
Oh no.
And you know, there's me like,
oh no,
panicking. You know. Planning, you know, thinking how my life's going to pan out, like paying overlords on insurance the rest of my life and stuff.
Right.
But I'm glad I didn't just say, oh, it's probably fine, there's a C. Right. I did get in contact with, you know, the chat line and mm-hmm. said, should I be worried? Because it looks like this is positive. And they looked at it and said, oh, it looks like it is a faulty test. So then ordered it again.
Oh no.
This time did it and negative. So
imagine having to wait 30 days to get your results. I mean, that's how it was back then. Like, imagine just sitting there waiting for a month, especially if you've been in, say, the situation Richie was, where he just saw a partner with Kaposi's sarcoma. It was a scary time, but at least now we have tests that are faster.
Yes, serological tests have really come a long way.
Although the COVID fast tests aren't very reliable, but but luckily, at least around here in Boston area, the regular test, the slow test, you can get. I had my results the next day, so that's good. How about the protest scenes? What did you think of those?
It reminded me of other shows or other movies, specifically like 120 BPMs, right. when it wasn't as hard to watch as It's a Sin, because the whole protests and activism and politics basically makes it easier to feel other things like
mm-hmm.
rage and
right.
like you're determined to see this fight go in the right direction, and you feel what the I assume the people were feeling and the characters in the situations feel, which is it is, I assume, kind of a relief to be throwing yourself in the politics of it, and having the feeling that you're fighting, right, instead of just all of the misery and dying. So in that sense, the whole protest was nice, because you see the community coming together, even though it's in small numbers. You see the parents coming. You see Colin's mother. You see. Right. All of them coming together.
And that almost never happened at protests, unfortunately. The parents didn't come out for protests, unfortunately, in those days.
I bet, but it was sweet and nice and terrible at the same time, because you've got these people insulting them on the street and the violence of the cops, beating our favorite characters.
Right.
But yeah, I guess that's my view of it.
Actually, I think you brought up a really interesting point there, which is that, I mean, I think when I look back on those times, you know, I mean, yes, the actual protests could be violent, not our protest, but the response from the police. We experienced violence, and they were scary and traumatizing. But at the same time, like you said, like fighting back just felt so good. You know, and the sense of community, and we're fighting in this together to help people. Like, I think in many ways, for those of us who did it, it helped us through it, you know, doing something so physically part of the solution. You know what I mean? Even if it doesn't seem it, you know, there is something very powerful about laying out in the street, and there's something about screaming in people's faces, and there's something about that was very cathartic. When we're living through all this horror and this sadness and all that, that there was something, there was a real sense of community that came from the protests that was really great, I think. And they got, you got a little sense of that in the show here.
Yeah. Well, I felt that as well. I mean, in Women's March, I felt that, and just meeting with so many people who think like you, and I, it is not the same thing, definitely, but we also like fight for terrible things to stop, like rape and child abuse and incest, and so it is good to be fighting and not just watching it all happen. And that was well depicted in the show, I think.
I was quite surprised by the ending to episode 4, because, you know, it seemed to be that there was a trend for episode 1, 2, 3 that, you know, this is a story about AIDS within the 80s, and like the typical people that we would think to die from that would be Roscoe, Ash, Richie, but it's actually not the people that you would think. So starting with Henry, someone that's been in a committed relationship for years, like decades. Then, well, Gregory, well, he says that he doesn't sleep around, but at the same time, he still has sex. And then, of course, Colin, that up to episode 2, we don't think he's actually had sex with anyone. So then when, you know, you see the police officer arrest Jill, I was thinking, oh, is Jill going to die? So glad that she didn't.
Right, no, that would have been bad. Well, the one thing too to remember is that actually makes sense, because if in real life, if you were out and active and part of the community, it's very likely you were having safer sex. So it makes sense that Roscoe didn't get it, that Ash didn't get it, because they probably were getting condoms every time they went to the club and were using them, hopefully. So
I think they make it clear that they weren't using condoms. That's why Roscoe says a few times, you know, don't thank God. I was just lucky with who I fucked. Like, so I think they were, I don't think they were using, you know, condoms.
No, I don't think so either.
I think, I mean, later, I think they
there's
probably
no reason why Richie would get it, and especially from his first kind of long-term partner.
Well, we don't know. We also have to remember, we don't know that Richie actually got it from him. I mean, Richie was sleeping around with everyone in town and probably without condoms through all of it. I mean, the first time we see him fucking with the boyfriend there, they actually use a condom and they don't know how to use it. So obviously this isn't something they're experienced with. So, I mean, I think they've been, he had lots and lots of sex. And I think to assume that he got it from the boyfriend.
We absolutely don't know.
Right. To assume that is probably not good. And speaking of him, by the way, if you didn't know, in real life, the actor who plays him has HIV and is open about it. So he's talked about how powerful it was to play this character back then, who, you know, probably ended up dying, where now he's got it and he will live a long life, hopefully. And, you know, so.
You mean Donald?
Yes.
The boyfriend? Okay.
Yes. The actor who plays him.
Okay.
In one of the after shows, he talks about that. What was I going to say? One thing, since we were talking about the protest scenes, is one thing is, I will say, luckily, we rarely encountered that level of brutality with the cops actually just beating you with clubs and whatever. Luckily, we didn't run into that very often, thankfully. But whenever I see it, on, you know, on TV or in a movie, it definitely is triggering for me because I did live through some nasty shit. I've got a scar where a cop stomped on me after calling me a faggot, and I've got, you know, we got maced and stuff like that. Of all the like quotes that really hit home for me was when the protest was about to start, and Jill is asking her friend how many people are coming, and he says we might make 50. And she said, that's not bad. And he says, there's 600,000 gay people in the city. Where the fuck are they? And he was echoing the thoughts of every single one of us at every protest in that whole era. It's like there were millions of gay men around the world. And I mean, in America and the UK, hundreds of thousands. And, you know, if we could get 50 people to show up to a protest, that was fucking huge. You know, it was easy to get like gay guys to come out for like a walk-a-thon or a dance-a-thon or something fun. And, you know, and there were certainly plenty who did care work and fundraising and buddying and all that. But to get them to like, you know, or to cry over the quilt, you know, that they would come out for. But to get them to actually like stand up and cause and go to a protest was like pulling teeth. It was really hard. And we encountered hostility from the community often. Like I'd give out leaflets after a night at the club and I'd have people rip them up and throw them in my face. You know, I'd be wearing an ACT UP shirt at the bar and someone would come up to me and be like, why are you people making everything worse? I'm like, we were dying by the thousands. How much fucking worse could we get?
The only other thing that I would mention is I just think that in episode 2, when Richie goes through that whole bar hopping description of AIDS and all the myths around it, that's just the highlight. Well, one of the highlights of the series for me, and I can see why that was used in a lot of the promotion stuff.
Right. Yeah, and it was well filmed, certainly.
Yep, and it really gave me a queer British version, Queer as Folk vibe as well.
I don't think I ever watched the whole thing. I watched the American one, but. But I would watch anything Russell T Davies did.
I love that Richie is playing a part in Doctor Who.
Do you know what's? That's actually a tribute to a real actor who was on Doctor Who for a story. It was actually later than this. It was in the 90s. It was an actor named Dernsley McLinden who was in the story Remembrance of the Daleks. He was a gay man who had HIV who went on to do a lot of fundraising for AIDS. And he did die a couple of years later. He died in 95. And that scene was meant to be a tribute to him. So,
okay.
Which is nice.
Yeah, thanks.
Russell always manages to throw a little Doctor Who in everything too, right?
I mean, yeah.
Well, thanks for joining me today for this discussion. And thanks for everyone that listened.
Yeah. Thank you, Glenn, for hosting. Thanks, Glenn.
Yeah, thank you to everyone. And I'm actually happy I watched the show,
just
to make it clear, even though it was really, like, I just cried so much, but yeah.
It was tough, yeah.
Yeah. So, thank you, and I'm going to go and eat something, and I will talk to you all soon. It's been the Vassals of Kingsgrave. Yay. Okay, bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Have a
nice evening.
Good to talk to you guys.